answers. Just start taking the testimony and wait for somebody to show up. Yeah. You can do that.
I think that's a good idea.
Good afternoon. Today is Monday, February 23rd, 2015. The Senate Committee on Transportation and Public Safety is called to order. We will start this afternoon with Senate File 345. So, Senator Johnson. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, members. I have Senate File 345. I would like to have an amendment added to it if someone would be willing to move the A1 amendment.
I'll move it. Senator Senjum moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you. Members, this was a constituent who requested that myself and Jerry Newton, who is my representative, to carry this bill and to offer it as a way to award and honor the Purple Heart veterans in Minnesota. And so I agreed to do that, very happy to say that I've been able to ask Bob Locker, the commander from the American Legion Post 303, and Chuck Jones, commander from the Military Order of the Purple Heart in Minnesota, to come up and testify and tell you a little bit about why we think it's an important bill.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself.
Well, thank you for having me. My name is Charles Jones. I usually go by Chuck, and it's good to see some familiar faces here that I met probably a month or so ago, just as everybody was getting seated on their new positions. But I am the state commander for the Department of Minnesota Military Order of the Purple Heart. This is my second term, and I've seen in the past, I would say year and a half, a lot of people, not only politicians, seem to have come out of the woodwork to kind of recognize people that have been wounded in conflict. Not only like myself, I was in Vietnam in 1966-67. I have three Purple Hearts, and like I was telling Senator next to me here that
Johnson
that I never even knew about the Purple Heart because everything was kind of hush-hush when I got out of the military. And it took me almost 40 years to hear people talking to me because that's how long it took before I got my first pair of hearing aids. And in the Department of Minnesota, we have right now 1,500 members who have come out of the woodwork and chose to become members of the Military Order of the Purple Heart. When I go around and talk to different organizations and people, I tell the people that, you know, we're not in it for the benefits. I don't even call them benefits. I call them things such as, you know, these are things that you are entitlements or entitled to. When you sign on the dotted line to serve this country and the people of it, they are things that were promised to you. But everybody seemed to have kept things quiet. And I know out there, with the 1,500 members that we have presently in the department, there's got to be 2 to 3 times that many out there that are still in their little cocoon that haven't come out of the woodwork. And recently, like I say, in the last year or two, a lot of organizations and people have come out to push for the veteran, you know, give them a little benefit here and there, or an entitlement, which they are deserving of. And with any little thing that could be put back into the veterans' hands, I would say that it'll draw more people out of the woodwork. And along with this, you're going to have people, like I know in the past year, I put a lot of miles on my car running for tee it up for the troops and the fishing programs that they have, Fishing for Life. We have a guy right now that's putting up a directory together for all veterans, not just Purple Heart veterans. And what it is once a year, a lot of the local people will give the veteran a free lunch or a cup of coffee or whatnot. This directory is going to be every day of the year, and it's carrying over into other states that are trying to join the bandwagon so that veterans and their families have a little bit, if they go to Texas for the winter or down to Florida, they know if they need tires, they can go to this tire company and get a certain discount for them. So it's not only getting us recognition, but it's also turning around and getting the different organizations or businesses a little pat on the back and also getting them some business. So it's a win-win for everybody. And I know trying to get the Purple Heart designation on the driver's licenses would, again, if these members know that it's on there and they can go to a national park or whatever, or a state park, and get in without paying the whatever the cost is, I don't even know. But I think it would be another plus in their favor. So that's why I'm here today, to hopefully kind of sway somebody in here, or hopefully all of you. And like I say, I don't care if you're a Republican, Democrat, or independent, you know. Thank the vets, because we stuck our life out on the line for everybody here. And people in this country, it's about time they started realizing what all these different so-called skirmishes and anything but called war has done for the people of this country. And with that, I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Senator Johnson, would you want to take questions now, or would you like to continue with the testimony and then do it all at once?
Madam Chair, I would like to ask our Commander Bob Locker to make a couple of statements. I'm very pleased to have he's not my constituent, but he's a commander of the post that's very close where my husband, Richard Jefferson, who is a former state representative, is a member of that post. And so I think I'm honored to have Commander Locker here to support this bill.
Welcome, Commander. Please introduce yourself.
Well, thank you. I'm the commander at the – my name's Bob Locker. I'm the commander at the Fridley American Legion in Fridley. I think this bill is really is going to be good for a lot of the especially these younger ones that are now coming back. I have Purple Heart 24, 25-year-olds in my post, 100% disabled. One fellow is shot in the back of the head and come out his eye, took 3-4 years of surgery to put him to where he's walking around now and stuff. Of course, he has a lot of limitations, you know, can't drive and things like this, but his family does, of course. And the big thing for these young veterans coming back, male or female, is to keep them busy, keep them doing things, and what better, you know, is the parks. We've got a lot of beautiful parks in Minnesota, and I believe that something like this can really keep them. We've had the same kind of veteran come back and actually commit suicide after a while, just can't find themselves, can't find the right job or any job. So I think something like this is really can help these wounded veterans. So I can only speak for the Fridley American Legion. I have chairs at the district and department level, but I can't speak for them. There is a commander's task group. Those things can go through. But I really think this will help us at the local level work these fellows back through and ladies back through the and into our regular civilization. And so I'm glad to be here today. If there's any questions, I'll try to answer them.
Well, thank you both for your service, both in the past and in the present, and for all of your efforts advocating for our veterans. It's very much appreciated. Senator Sinjum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, again, from all of us, as was cited, thank you for your service. I just have a question about the Purple Heart in general. And I think I know the answer, but who awards it? We, I think we pretty well understand that a Purple Heart is, if you will, given to someone that that's physically injured in combat. What about the psychological issues? Would one of those an individual suffering some, you know, some psychological problems, would they be awarded a Purple Heart for that? And then the other one is, we've had a lot of Minnesota National Guard soldiers deployed. Are National Guard soldiers eligible for the Purple Heart? So about two or three questions there.
Okay. Commander Jones.
First, the National Guard. If they're in a combat situation and wounded under hostile conditions, they will get a Purple Heart award. It's something that no matter what you do or try to do while you're in the military, you can't apply for it. You have to be awarded it. It's something that, because of wounds you received under combat conditions or hostile conditions, you will receive a Purple Heart. How it's gone about being awarded today, I don't really can say exactly how it is awarded, whether it be by, I know when I was in Vietnam, if you were wounded and a medical tag went back to the rear area, I guess it's up to the organization that you're with to present you with a Purple Heart. I got one Purple Heart, the medal, or, you know, in the little band that you wear on your coat. The other two, after that, you just get a certificate that specifies or stated on the date you were wounded and where and all that stuff. It could be today be awarded by a company commander or the outfit that you belong to now that when you come back here to the States. It could be, sometimes I think they even have people, their wives pin it on them at a ceremony when they have gotten the award. But it's nothing that, you know, if, for our organization, we require a copy of your DD-214, which states on there you were awarded the Purple Heart Medal. And if it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But we have to have certification that you were wounded before we let you into our organization. And sometimes it's hard for people. I just got off the phone with a guy this morning about 2 hours ago who was in Korea and got a bayonet wound in his arm. And he's saying that he got a letter back from somebody out in where they award these awards and whatnot that he needed to come up with some kind of verification. And he wanted to know who might have sent this in. I said, you know, that was even before I was born. So I think it would be something in the line that if he was in the Marines, you'd have to get a hold of the Marine Corps, and they could dig up your record somehow. There's a lot of ways that you can get the information on it. But, you know, today there's so many people out there saying, oh, I got the Medal of Honor, and I have this and that, that we want verification to know that you're eligible to be awarded the Purple Heart. And it's not too hard to dig up records. If they have to dig up records, they will. And there's a lot of different means of finding out, because we have a lot of people going out saying they have two Purple Hearts and a few other medals and whatnot, only to find out they're just all full of baloney. So we find that out. That's that Stolen Valor Award deal. And they can be prosecuted for that. So there's ways of finding out if you were awarded. And I just recently found out that, I don't know, how many years ago was at Fort Hood that the psychiatrist out there went goofy and decided to shoot up the place. And, you know, they finally changed that so those people out there would be given Purple Hearts, because up until very recently it was considered a workplace violence. And now that the people in Pentagon and whatnot reviewed the whole case and whatnot, they finally declared it was that guy who went, he was with the, I guess, the Taliban or whoever, and now they're awarding those people a Purple Heart out there. So there's a lot of changes in the laws, but up until just very recently, you had to be wounded by an enemy and have verification of it.
And thank you, Commander. And I think we'll hear a testimony from Ms. McCormick from Driver and Vehicle Services, and she's probably going to be able to address some of the technicalities in the process, if that helps, Senator St. John.
Yeah.
Okay. Madam Chair, and Senator St. John, that was a very good question, and I will try to do a little more research on the mental health issues, whether that is considered for a Purple Heart before the bill comes to another either committee or to the floor. So very good. I had not thought about that.
And Commander?
Going back to that mental thing, up until very recently again, people are coming back from Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, and they're getting wounded by IEDs that blow up their trucks or whatever they're in, and they have traumatic brain injuries, and people are being awarded for that also. It's just very recently been under consideration, and people that have traumatic brain injuries, which could very well lead to PTSD and whatnot, that they too will be awarded a Purple Heart.
Thank you. Senator Rossman.
Madam Chair, what's the destination of this bill? Is this going up to the going to general orders, or are we sending it to another stop?
This will be going to finance, and it will need to go to Senator Tomasoni's committee.
Okay.
For the parks and the state parks aspect of it.
Okay. With that, Madam Chair, I'd move the passage of Bill Senate File 345 as amended, and send it on to its next destination.
Thank you, Senator. We do have one more testifier that we should hear from Ms. McCormick before we proceed with the motion, if we can.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then we adopted the amendment, and I would like to offer or ask our Senate counsel to explain why this was drafted, along with the person from the Department of Motor Vehicle.
Welcome, Ms. McCormick. Ms. Berezovsky, do you want to address first? Or,
Madam Chair and Senators, my understanding is that the reason the effective date was changed is because, and Ms. McCormick, I'm sure, will address this, but that there will have to be a new contract with a vendor to design a new driver's license and state identification card that would have the room for this designation on it. So the effective date had to be tied to that occurrence.
Thank you, Ms. Berezovsky. Ms. McCormick.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. And our driver's license contract that we have right now requires us to, anytime we make a change to the card, it costs $75,000. And so as a result, we had the veterans designation, as some of you may remember, and that is tied to us having a new card. And so when we were talking with Senator Johnson, we asked if that might be a possibility. We are preparing an RFP, and we should be issuing it in the near future. I can't give you a date, but it will be soon. And so these designations could be added with the new card design that we would be getting when we hire a contract vendor to work with us for the new production and design of the new driver's license. So that was the reason for the amendment. In terms of the questions that were asked about the things, the documents that would be needed for those who have an award, that would include what's called the DD-214 discharge paper or a DD-215 discharge update, or there could be service records that show the award of the Purple Heart, a letter from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, or military orders of the award. So those would be the documentation that would be necessary for us to put that on the driver's license. And I'd be glad to answer any other questions anyone may have.
Members, any questions? Senator St. John.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the to Ms. McCormick, I think you said it, but just go back in my memory a little bit. Do we currently have an opportunity for the veterans designation? I had someone back home that was always talking to me about that, and I never got it done, but maybe somebody else did.
Ms. McCormick.
Madam Chair and Senator Senjum, yes, that is part of the law. Yeah. It is just waiting until we get the new driver's license contract in place, and that's the language that Senator Johnson is using that and adding this to is the language that we currently have, so that the veterans designation will be on there. And this past session, we also passed legislation related to special hunting and fishing privileges for disabled veterans. So that also would be another designation that would be provided on the driver's license.
Okay.
Any additional questions? Commander?
I have a question for the end down here. I forget your name.
Pat McCormick.
Pat McCormick, okay. On here, on this page here, it says Section 2. This would possibly be take effect, it says, immediately for applications submitted after January 1st of 2016. Now, my driver's license expires in November of this year. And when you get your driver's license, what is it, for 4 or 5 years? I don't know. But I know it's more than 1 year. So if this were to take effect, would I get it this birthday, or would I have to wait another 5 years to have it?
Ms. McCormick.
Madam Chair, we would you would not have to renew your driver's license, but if you wanted a change in your driver's license because you wanted that designation, whenever it would occur, it would be a duplicate license that you would request, so that you can, that it's not as expensive, but since you already have a license in effect, it wouldn't be renewing your driver's license. It would be a duplicate license that would, you would have these designations on then.
Thank you, Mr. McCormick. Mm-hmm. So seeing no other questions, Senator Osmond. Sorry, Senator Central.
Mr. Chair, I just have to ask one. This is clumsy. I mean, we certainly obviously honor service and so on and so forth. Is there something special about, I mean, certainly there is some, I can answer that. I mean, a Purple Heart is a noble sacrifice. There are other, certainly, medals of valor that servicemen, women get. If we're going to do this, is there a like reason why we wouldn't consider an opportunity at least for people to designate other medals or medals of valor that they might have received through their military experience? I mean, is it right to just single out the Purple Heart? Is there a special reason for doing that as opposed to honoring other medals of valor?
Madam Chair, I don't have a scientific knowledge about why that might be, but I think it's because this certain constituent thought it was important and came to me and or to Jerry, sure. Senate Representative Newton, and myself, and asked for this particular privilege.
Okay.
And so I don't think there's any reason that there couldn't be more added, but I suppose it would be cost.
Sure.
Ms. McCormick?
Madam Chair, the only thing I would add to what was Senator Johnson said is that the veterans designation also does allow for certain other privileges for people to have, and that's why there are a lot of veterans that want that designation on their driver's license. So there are some benefits in having that on the driver's license, and so hopefully we will be able to get it. We put it on the driving record so that we have that information that on there, but it's not, I think veterans want that information on the card. And so hopefully we'll be able to do that in the near future.
I'm asking too many. I'm sorry. So, Ms. McCormick, if I understood, certainly the veteran, you get a vet, I don't know how you do it, but it's the veteran designation on the card. But if that same veteran had been recipient of a Distinguished Flying Cross, for instance, would that opportunity to have that in some fashion be on that driver's license? Does that exist?
Ms. McCormick.
Other medals of valor, whatever they might be.
Madam Chair and Senator Senjum, no, that doesn't exist right now. So,
other questions, members? Senator Wieger.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment, Commander. You had mentioned earlier whether we knew what the Purple Heart was, and I thought so much of my childhood. My dad had a Purple Heart, and so growing up, we knew that that meant that he almost died in battle in World War II. Parts of a grenade that exploded that were in his head, causing headaches throughout his life. He's not with us anymore. And the recipients of this honor have almost met their maker on the battlefield. I'm fully supportive of whatever we can do to recognize, veterans. There will be a day at the Hill, I think, coming up very soon where we can talk about other areas, but I know what's behind the Purple Heart. I remember that medal being a place of honor and handed down through our family. I also remember Dad's love for the parks and what a nice fit, and that we can show that, and having shown his family, which included me, most Minnesota parks growing up. And so I wanted to thank you, Senator Johnson, your testifiers, for this recognition of your service.
Thank you, Senator Wieger.
Let's say one more thing.
Commander, yes.
You know, this award, or the Purple Heart, is probably one of the longest awards that have been around. I mean, this goes back to when George Washington was out there, and he started out with a little piece of cloth that said merit on it. I have a replica of that at home. And this has been going right down the line ever since, like I said, when George was floating across the river. Mm-hmm. And I had a lady come to me after giving a talk at the hospital where we worked at. And she had an original letter from her uncle that was wounded back in World War I. And we did a lot of tracing and working our way back and found out that the family had been given, or he had been given, a Purple Heart, but nobody knew where it was. And this lady persevered and got documentation, and we took it all the way back as far as we could and found out not only did he get a Purple Heart, but another medal or two. And we presented it to them, and she took it out to his grave and put the medals there on the tombstone. And she was just so happy, her and the family, because not only did he get his Purple Heart, but he got other stuff that nobody was aware of. So little things like that really mean an awful lot. And I know Senator Klobuchar has really been a big thing on digging up a lot of information, and I've worked with her in her office about presenting Purple Hearts to people that didn't get theirs, or it was lost in the transit or whatnot. So it is an award that really means something to not only the veteran but to their family. And with that, that's about all I could add to it.
Thank you, Commander. It is very significant, and we appreciate your observations on that. Senator. Thank you. Any other questions, members? Seeing none, Senator Osmick, do you wish to renew your motion that we pass Senate File 345 as amended and refer it to Finance? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Committee.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. Up next, we will have Senate File Number 80 with Senator Wieger. State Park. Okay. Just says. Senator Wieger, whenever you're ready.
think about it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Senate File 80 relates to trunk highway projects. Currently, cities have the power to review and give consent on MnDOT road projects. The provision before you would allow this same review consent power to counties. So just as cities have this authority, we would extend it to counties. The proposal is initiated by Ramsey County, and to testify as to the need for the provision, I have Ramsey County Commissioner Janice Rettman, and she'll give further background.
Thank you. Welcome, Ms. Rettman. Please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, my name is Janice Rettman. I represent District 3 in Ramsey County, and it is literally the heart of the I-35E corridor, which brings me to the genesis of this legislative request to include counties in the consent process of the MnDOT highway projects. It comes from the Cayuga I-35E Cayuga project, as well as the I-35E MenPass projects. This addition would add not only value to the component of MnDOT, but the residents and all levels of government, and would have saved a tremendous amount of time by all parties concerned, and would have achieved a resolution with an involved citizenry. This request would give counties a seat at the table and would run concurrent, not elongate the process. It is not meant to elongate or to layer on, but to be at the table. Additionally, this addresses the federal executive order 12898, which you all know as part of the environmental justice tenets, that assures the involvement of all peoples in areas of development and redevelopment, especially where there are concentrated areas of poverty and or people of color. This is Ramsey County, and I personally am colorblind. It's a rare thing for women, but I'm colorblind. But the thing of it is, and I will be more than willing to provide many copies of this, is there's a bright red area. I-35 is right here. This is the area. This is St. Paul. This part. All of this is Ramsey County. The area in bright red, there are 8 precincts that all have economic poverty and people of color in excess of 50%. The gold area, it is in excess of 39 to 50%. The gold area also is a part of this heart of the I-35E corridor. It is the area I represent on both sides of I-35E. I represent it from Larpenter all the way down to, I come right down to Ryerson University. So you are in the area right near. Since counties are the boots on the ground with citizens, as well as funding partners in many, if not all, of these projects, the county inclusion process would be most beneficial. In the I-35E, Cayuga, and MenPass projects, the elimination of a well-used underpass trail connection and the removal of the diagonal bridge across the I-35E literally cut off hundreds of people's and residents' their daily access to jobs, physicians, schools, transit, etc. Many have no cars, many work minimum wage jobs, and many of them walk that trail every night or every early morning after working overnight. And walking is their primary mode of transportation. Often in rental housing and often not having computer access, neither MnDOT nor the City of St. Paul included these users in the process. And it was only the county, and I will tell you, it was only the county and respectfully me, which is working with and for the people, to fight to have this. Only after 2 years of the outcries of redress directed by the citizens and an overflow crowd when actually the citizens were invited in, was MnDOT willing to at least give a restoration of a very subtle connectivity that could have been done if at the outset had we had this consent. This is permissive language that would give the counties the ability to daylight the issues as well as assist MnDOT in ensuring environmental justice for all at the outset and bringing it, which I believe would bring it in on time and on budget, not elongating it. Because the consent component is already found in transit legislation. And so this is just bringing it similarly. And I believe it would help be cost-effective, inclusive, value-added, promote coordination, have funding transparency and stewardship, and fiscal stewardship, create better multimodal transportation systems statewide, and provide access to all people, be them on foot or in or on a one-wheel, two-wheel, three-wheel, or four-wheel. And I thank you for listening today. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Weger, an additional comment?
Well, Madam Chair, excuse me, there is a fiscal note, and I believe MnDOT would like to comment, and then we'd stand for questions, discussion.
Thank you. Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Rettman, I'm reading the bill. What would you believe would be the outcome if a municipality gave consent and a county didn't, and we continued to have those disagreements going forward? Would it just kill the whole project?
Ms. Rettman.
Madam Chair, Senator, very good. Let me be very clear. When it went through municipal consent, they just thumbprinted it. It came through. And I personally went to Commissioner Zelli and said, are you aware that you are taking out this trail and all of this? And it was like the city signed off. I'm saying if we're at the table at the time, then we can daylight it. And this is an and or. This is not... This language says the municipality or the county. If you have everybody at the table, you can daylight those. And then over the 2 years that we had the meetings, literally, finally with MnDOT, listening at the table, the city was there, the county was there, MnDOT was there, the residents were there, and we finally struck this deal. But when it came down to putting more money in, which it went from $6 million down to $3 million down to a few hundred thousand dollars, less than $500,000. The county kicked in money, and the state kicked in money. The city didn't kick in any more dollars. If we'd have had that at the outset, we wouldn't have had to waste the time. And I'm not good at wasting time or wasting money.
Oh, okay. Thank you,
Senator Champion.
You know, Madam Chair, thank you. I believe that Senator Senjum asked a question that I had, but I'm not quite sure that I understood the answer at this particular time. So if the bill is permissive and says or as the conjunction, and so then that means that someone can decide if they want to go to the municipality or to the county, then if that's true, then help me understand what would be the purpose of this particular bill, because then you could end up in the same position that you are today. So perhaps someone can answer that question.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, my apologies. What I'm saying is if we're all notified at the same time, we have the ability to do it. I don't care if it comes in as one way or the other. The thing of it is we're at the table. The consent in transit does the same thing. The consent is I believe, an or. It's not, but it gives us, at the same time, we both have the information and we can meet with the people. I'd love it if it was and, because then you have to be around the table and then the final decision is made.
Senator Champion.
Madam Chair, thank you for your response. I'm just still not quite certain as unless Senator Wicker is able to point to language in the bill that says all parties are to be giving notice or the information. I don't necessarily see that unless I'm missing that in the bill someplace.
I'm wondering,
Senator. No, Madam Chair, I am advancing this as requested by the county, so I'm assuming it reflects what their intent is. If they'd like further amendment, I'm open for that.
Senator, and I was going to say Mr. Scott Peterson was going to testify. I don't know if he would be able to add any comments on this process as well, but Senator Sengem.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and perhaps to tag on to my good friend's comment. When I was a city council member, when we did municipal consent approvals, we did them at the council table. Seven people voted, and it would seem to me that you wouldn't take that away. It's not who's around the table at the so-called meeting. It's who's around the table at the official meeting at which the council decides, and in this case, the county board then would have to decide also at a separate meeting. That's why I'm still kind of wondering about two consents and what happens if there's a conflict.
Commissioner,
Madam Chair, and I'm going to try and be as delicate as I can be, which sure generally isn't very delicate. Is what happened is it was supposed to be registered at the city council as a public hearing. There was a miscommunication. It was not listed as a public hearing. And then I can't speak for sure the city council of how it handled it. The thing of it is that the issues were not addressed with MnDOT, and they went on and got the city consent. We kept on raising these at the county board meeting, and they said, you do not have municipal consent, so therefore the city trumps it. Okay. I just want a way to be at the table so that we do not waste, be it Commissioner Zelli's time or all levels of government. If we're all around the table at the same time, at least everything gets daylighted, including the residents.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Peterson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Scott Peterson from MnDOT. And I'd just like to, excuse me, to start out by saying, we have some concerns with the bill, but the situation that Senator Sengem was pointing to is one of our primary concerns is if the way we read the bill is we need both consent from city and county if the project falls within the limits of both. And then what is the department's course of action if we're unable to get the city and county to agree on what the outcome should be? And to a great extent, that is what happened in this project and is probably the reason why the bill is before you today, and that we worked with the city extensively, and the city granted consent. There's a difference of opinion on some of the features of the project that Commissioner Rettman referred to, in which there was a disagreement based around the total bicycle planning for the community and a number of other issues, and we eventually got resolved. But just to kind of give a more broader perspective on our concerns on the bill, first of all, every project, certainly projects of the scope of which these two 35E projects are, we do extensive public outreach process. We realize that whenever you do a big infrastructure project like this in a developed urban area, the costs and benefits fall unevenly across the population, and so we work hard to try to minimize or mitigate the negative impacts on local communities while trying to broaden and maximize the benefits available to them and the people who will use the finished corridor. That doesn't mean that we're always perfect, and in this case, I would agree with Commissioner Rettman that better communication with some of the populations in the area would have been a good idea on the part of MnDOT, and we have had conversations with her and other members of the Ramsey County Board about things that we can do working with them to try to identify a better way to accomplish that, but short of what's required in this legislation. One of the primary things that comes out of these negotiations with cities in our experience because of the municipal consent requirement is there is usually a disagreement at some point about what is needed to do a project and what is wanted to get a project. And that and just, you know, kind of like normal difference of opinion, it can really stretch out the project development process and lead to some cost increases as a result. The requirements of this bill would mean that every project in the state of Minnesota that changed access, improved capacity, or needed additional right-of-way would have to go through one or two consent processes because every project would be in a county of some kind. Again, that's more cost, and you have the fiscal note, and it doesn't look like it's an exorbitant cost, but, you know, this is something that we don't have a lot of experience with, so this is our best estimate at the time. But one of the things that's happened in the last couple of years is because of the length of time it was taken to get through the municipal consent process, we came to the legislature and asked them to put some time parameters around some of the steps in the process. And that was pretty successful for a while in kind of moving the process along systematically and getting issues resolved. But now what we've started to see are conditional municipal consent resolutions. That is, so the city council will say, well, we'll give you municipal consent provided you meet these conditions. So it's a consent, but still without all the issues unresolved. So then we're still not in a position to move forward with the project, even though we may technically have some kind of consent. So one of the other things that we have had happen, then again, because of the need for the department to complete this process, is we've had now cities come back and ask for things that are outside the scope of the project in order to get municipal consent. So it's not just about the attributes of the project we want to get built, but it's about the attributes of that project and what it will do and the impacts it will have, but also some of the attributes of other projects that we've done in the past in the city. For example, we had one municipal consent agreement that asked us to repay the city for a share that it had already paid for an aesthetic railing on a bridge on a prior project as a condition for municipal consent for the project that we're currently before the city on. So, again, it's not addressing the merits of whether that was the right or wrong thing. That was an agreement we entered into. And then if we have to kind of move back and relook at old agreements in order to move forward with our current project agreements, again, it's just more process, more delay. There's also another case where a city asked us to revisit sound issues associated with a bridge that was built, again, as part of an earlier project, not related to the current project, but as a condition for municipal consent of the current project. On another project, we added 50% to the landscaping funds for the project at the request of the city. Again, not weighing in on the merits of whether it was needed or not, but it was, at the end of the day, that was required to get the agreement completed. Also, there's requirements to repaint noise walls. Again, existing noise walls, not a part of the project. There is some additional money provided for more aesthetic treatments, 3% of a budget to improve noise walls. And then also they asked that we replace some older noise wall that was within the project limits that had been there for a while so that it would match the new noise wall that we'll be putting up as part of the project. And then we had a case with one city where we sent them what we thought was a municipal consent final agreement, and when we got the agreement back, it had added that MnDOT would pay for sidewalks. Again, in their final resolution, an item that we had not negotiated to accept. But at that point, our choice is, well, do we accept this resolution as submitted, or do we go back and try to work through the process of getting these sidewalk costs out of there or just pay for the sidewalk costs? So, and there are other examples, too. Another one that comes to mind, and I'll just kind of leave it at that, is that we had another project where the community asked us to build a bicycle trail and bike ped bridge over a freeway as part of the municipal consent process, but the bike trail and bridge were not within the project limits, so they weren't a replacement. They were new. And again, not weighing in on whether that was a good thing or a bad thing. It just seems like there needs to be an opportunity to control the scope on these projects if we're ever going to be able to complete the number of projects that we need. So a couple of other interesting things that I think are worth noting is the Minnesota County Engineers Association annually prepares a legislative priorities list. This legislation is not something that they're supporting this year. And in fact, the Minnesota County Engineers Association in their legislative priorities is asking for removal of the municipal consent requirement for them for county state aid projects within city limits. So I think that reflects the fact that they understand that there are difficulties with this requirement to get municipal consent and are looking for other ways to kind of address some of these issues that come up in the process of developing these projects. And as I mentioned to Commissioner Rettman, the one this was heard in the House, is we have, as a result of a meeting between her and Commissioner McDonough and myself and the Commissioner, we agreed to put together a task force to kind of look at, you know, how do these issues develop, what's the right way to resolve them in the interest of the taxpayers and all the affected governing bodies. And we're committed to doing that. We'd actually already started that process before our last meeting, but as a result of the input that we got, we're going to kind of expand the represented constituencies in that process and really try to maybe look at this more comprehensively than just in a more narrow scope. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Senator Kiffmeyer, did you have a question?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. To follow up on that, one of the things that I heard here was about notice, you know, making sure everybody's noticed. This bill still does not necessarily, that I can see enough, that it includes that, if that is, but because the only changes I see are adding the word or county. So could you maybe tell me about when you do some of these projects, what's the current kind of notice you give to municipalities or counties when you're initiating or working on a project?
Mr. Peterson.
Madam Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, good question. So the project development process, as many of you have had, you know, significant highway projects in your districts, they typically involve a long time frame. And one of the first things we do when we identify a need to do some construction in a particular area is reach out to the public and the local governments. And so we have an internal policy. It's called Hear Every Voice. And again, I'm not going to defend to the nth degree our ability to execute that policy perfectly. But we do make, I believe, a very good faith attempt to reach all the affected communities. We have, again, struggled at times to reach communities that we may not maybe know are out there because of changes in demographics. You know, we rely a lot on public information, just as an example. And so all of that work precludes the point at which the municipal consent process begins. So we're required to present a layout to the governing body, and that by the time that layout is prepared, we've done a lot of that work to kind of find out what are the key issues and what are the features that we need to build into the project in order to accommodate some of the public concerns we've had, both from our public meetings with local residents and with local governments.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, would you mind, Senator, if I just respond very
absolutely.
Briefly?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I'm perhaps not a normal elected official because I go where two or three are gathered together. I'm there. I try to be. And in terms of, I went up to Jenny Reed, who was on the I-35E Cayuga with MnDOT, and I told her if they would provide me literally a handout in four languages, because I've got Hmong, Somali, Hispanic, and English, if they would hand it, I would personally deliver it to every person because the majority of people do not have that access. And the way the neighborhood got the people to come to the meeting that was finally held literally 17 months into the process was to get out on the trail and walk the trail with the people. This was not adding bells and whistles. And the thing of it is, what the county could bring forward is that outreach that includes renters, because homeowners and owners were notified, but not renters. And when you have the majority of the people that used this part of the trail they were not noticed and during the municipal consent with the city. And that is what I'm saying is value added at everybody being at the table.
Thank you, Commissioner. Additional questions, members? And I would just say I appreciate Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Peterson, the question I have for you there right now, does MnDOT have a policy that if, you know, obviously we've heard a lot about how there's plenty of projects, and it just seems to me that we ought to give communities, you know, whatever, 60, 90 days to develop this consent, and if they don't want the money, then we just move on to the next project. Does MnDOT have a policy to kind of move on to the next project if we can't get consent?
Mr. Peterson.
Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, you know, to my knowledge, we don't have a specific policy with a time frame that we wait. Like I mentioned earlier, we came back to the legislature a few years ago and asked them to put some time frames in the process so that we would get some certainty, so that we could make some of those decisions at certain points in time if the process didn't meet the time frame. Our general attitude, I think, has been to try to work with the communities until we get some resolution, because usually we have invested a lot in the project by the time we're getting down to kind of some of the final negotiations over what's in the project and who pays for it. And so we have kind of, as a result, some inertia there, some innate reluctance to walk away. Right off the top of my head, I don't know of any projects that we've completely walked away from, but there have been projects that I'm aware of where we, you know, they've just been significantly delayed because of the inability to reach an agreement. And again, that's why we came back and asked for the timeframes in the legislation. But now, as I mentioned, also we're seeing communities try to work around the strict deadlines and pass a resolution of consent without actually completing a resolution of all the items.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Wieger.
Madam Chair, I want to thank you and members for your thoughtful consideration. And I believe everyone agrees that perhaps communications can be improved. And I appreciate that MnDOT is forming a task force to, you know, with Ramsey County, perhaps others, to address this. But we all know getting local input, you know, many of you served at the local level, whether it be on a county commission or a city council or a township board, and respecting that input in a major project, you know, for roadways is important. So I would think it would be good that if we could lay this over for possible inclusion. I believe there's a couple of references to or that should be and I think it would more clearly demonstrate the notice requirement. It's not looked at as being optional on notice, but just, you know, a heads up and awareness in the daylight. And Commissioner Rettman is so transparent in her 30 years of public service, and she's around and just wants to have that involvement as a passionate advocate for her area. But I believe the public deserves that type of notice throughout the state. Yes, there's ramifications, and I don't like to see things unduly delayed, but if it can result in a more thoughtful project, that would be the intent. So with those considerations, the potential of additional discussions, I would respectfully ask that we lay it over for possible inclusion in our policy omnibus bill.
Thank you, Senator Wieger, and that is the intent here. I appreciate it, and, you know, as a co-author of this bill, I know this has been an issue that was very challenging in that particular area, and this is not the first time we're hearing of that. And the problem is when we don't get all the voices at the table, when those voices finally get heard, often we end up saying, wait a minute, they were right, and we go back and in hindsight, go back and fix things, and that costs more money and time in the long run. So I appreciate the commitment on the part of everybody to try to improve this process, that the difference between notice and outreach can sometimes be a distinction that needs to be made. And so I do appreciate the work on the task force. So with that, we will lay this over.
Madam Chair.
Sorry. Senator Newman.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Before we lay the bill over for possible inclusion, Senator Wieger indicated that that there may be a change from the word "or" to include both the county and the municipalities, and I think that that would probably be appropriate given the testimony that we've heard. But when are we going to see that change if the bill is going to be laid over as is for possible inclusion?
We will revisit, Senator Newman, the language of the bill and have opportunities for amendments and to work with the department and come up with some solutions, I think.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Wiegert, would it be at your intention once the omnibus bill is put together to offer an amendment at that time?
Senator Wiegert.
Madam Chair, Senator Newman, yes, it would be my intent to either offer it as an amendment or potentially it would be reflected in a draft based on input. But
so I'm assuming that, Madam Chair, that we will see the changes before this bill is sent to the floor.
Senator Newman, yes.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Westrom and then Senator Champion. Oh,
Madam Chair, I realize we're going to try to lay it on the table. I just wanted to offer comment maybe for the author and witness and the DOT as they may try to look things over. But I would first maybe share Senator Senjum's concern and putting an "and" in there, I think might slow down the process, not speed it up. But I do look at the bill and it looks like sections 4, 5, 6, and 7 might be notice provisions that would be helpful, so the county earlier on as they're designing the plan and before they go out for bid would have notice of this, and if there were changes, that would
help in your situation and many others and give you information to be alerted to let the city know, if nothing else. It seems to me that the city council members that supported this, and maybe the witness knows, I mean, were they oblivious to this? Did they just completely miss the mark, or did they just not care? They're the ones that should have brought this issue up for their constituents, who are jointly also your constituents. I'd be curious to know what happened in that case, but it looks to me like at least the notice part of this bill would be helpful in your situation to at least know, but not to slow the process down.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair. I think that what happens some of the times in government is we rely on staff people, and the Public Works Department had worked with MnDOT. The City of St. Paul Public Works Department had worked with MnDOT, and they had made a decision that the underpass would have cost MnDOT an additional $6 million that they wanted instead of using at Cayuga. Area at the I-35E Cayuga, they wanted to move that into the Men Pass project and not spend the $6 million that would have continued the underpass. The thing of it is, the underpass was the only way to get to buses even, let alone anything back and forth. And it was not perceived as vital to the moving public, but it was vital to the people who were still needing to get to the places they are. So the notice went through MnDOT working with the City of St. Paul Public Works, and then they had said, yes, we're fine with the removal of it. Okay? It was only by happenstance that I was reading it and the neighborhood was reading it saying, where is it? Where is it? And Representative Connie Bernardi actually went out, you know, and I know we're in the Senate, and I know that I'm not mixing up y'all. I'm really not. Is she literally went out because I kept on talking about this trail. I call it a path, you know, because it wasn't hotsy-totsy, but it did the purpose. And it wasn't asking for a $6 million path. It was asking for the connectivity to still be there,
right.
And it had been taken out. And the city did not find that that was valuable. The taking out of the diagonal, you know, is I went out and personally took pictures that you would have to jump off the Maryland Avenue Bridge to get on the trail, you know, on the other side of I-35E. you know, from the east side on the west side. So the thing of it is I'm not going to say that they didn't do their due diligence because I'm not them. They had their public works staff doing their due diligence, and then they passed it. And
but, Madam Chair, two things. I mean, it's sounding to me like we can say that. I'm not putting words in your mouth, but if it's a big issue locally, that's why we have local.
Well, it ended up in the paper because, it, you know.
To represent them. But what I'm understanding is this is an underpass under 30 I-35, and now it's no longer there.
And now we've got a solution that will not be that way, but at least it will provide ADA accessible walking paths that are safe and away from cars, you know. Okay. And that's all they wanted. You know, this isn't hotsy-totsy, I swear to God.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Champion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to Senator Wieger, as you all are thinking about what proposed changes that you would put forward, I do think the and will end up slowing down the process, but Senator Sinjum has started to go down a pathway that I was initially going to go, which is if you put the and there, what happens in a situation when two different bodies who need to give consent disagree? What if one says yes and another says no? The bill should speak to that question because that is something that could honestly occur. And so with that being said, I'm not asking for anything specific today, but I would hope that you would give that some consideration for this particular body if this body thinks that this bill should be included with its proposed amendments to be included in omnibus bill.
No, Madam Chair. Senator Champion, that's a point very well taken. And as Senator Peterson maybe suggested, if the local government can't get it together, maybe you move on to the next project.
Thank you.
But then,
Senator Champion.
But then, Senator Wieger, then are we not now putting another layer of responsibility and time, effort, and money that's been spent on one, and then now you're going to the next? And then what if it keeps happening in that context? And I don't think that, based on the proposal that's been articulated thus far, and I'm not suggesting that it's been fully fleshed out, but as it's been, you know, articulated thus far, really answers the question as to how do we keep these projects moving in a responsible way.
Madam Chair, Senator Champion, it's our intent that the project move in a responsible way.
Thank you. All right. Seeing no further questions on this issue, thank you, Senator Wieger, Commissioner Mr. Peterson. And with that, Senate File 80 will be laid over possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. A couple of very quick announcements before we wrap up. Tomorrow afternoon at 5 o'clock is the deadline for people to RSVP for the Friday hearing in Albert Lea. So we hope everyone will join us in Albert Lea on the bus for the transportation hearing. And please let Suzanne Sabatka know by 5 o'clock tomorrow if you'll be able to join us. And then, in addition, we will have committee on Wednesday. We will be hearing Senate File 86, the automated license plate reader bill. So everybody come on time and be prepared for an interesting discussion. With that, we are adjourned.